Case number 10-3083 et al. United States of America versus Juan Jose Martinez Vega, also known as Chiquero, also known as Gentile Alves Pitino, appellant.
Good morning, counsel. Since we have so many different appearances today, we'd appreciate it if you would identify yourself and who you're representing.
Certainly, Your Honor. My name is Richard Gilbert. I represent Mr. Martinez Vega, and I was his trial counsel, as well as representing him on this appeal. I have 10 minutes this morning. What I'd like to do is, first of all, reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if the court's questioning permits that. Secondly, let me make clear that the two issues that I intend to talk about this morning, of the joint issues, are both the essentially the importation issues, that is, the sufficiency of the evidence that the defendants knew that the any cocaine they were involved with was going to the United States, and also the question of the sufficiency of the jury instructions. I do want to make one thing clear, though, because as perhaps the court has gleaned from reading the briefs, the factual allegations against Mr. Martinez Vega and Mr. Cuevas were quite different. They operated in entirely different parts of Colombia, and they had no direct relationship with each other. So if you do have questions that pertain to the factual matters against Mr. Cuevas, it's our understanding that Mr. Rettereta will take some of his time to address those questions. As far as the two issues I'd like to talk about, I'm going to start, if you permit, with the issue of the instruction, as quite frankly, that has a much, much more favorable standard of review for the appellants. And frankly, this is inexplicable to me. The fact that the defendants had to have personal knowledge or the intent to import the cocaine in the United States is unequivocally an element of the offense. And the instruction that we proffered was, I think, clear and concise and explained to the jury that particular element. That's the law in this jurisdiction. The Martinez case, which the government relies on in the context of the sufficiency of the evidence, is precisely a case where there was an objection to the instructions, but it was harmless in part because the judge in that case gave the same type of instruction we requested. Why the trial judge in this case declined to give that instruction, I simply cannot understand.
It's about imports?
Yes, that the defendants had to have the personal knowledge or the personal intent that the drugs with which they, in the conspiracy they were involved with, was going to the United States.
What do we do with the Childress case where the district court actually instructed on conspiracy as a general intent crime and nonetheless we found harmless error in the instructions?
Well, I don't have the facts for that case at my fingertips, Your Honor, but I will say that in this particular case, we're talking about an element of the offense, a particular mens rea, and because of the way the judge continued the instruction, it actually led the jury away from this conclusion. When the judge instructed the jury that the defendants need not have agreed to all the details, they need not have been fully informed of all the details, they need not know the full extent of the conspiracy or all the actions of its members, they didn't have to know they were violating any particular law, they only had to be aware generally of the unlawful nature of their conduct.
The instruction, I'm on JA 1716, that talked about there has to be an agreement to import, or during the relevant time frame, the allegation was an agreement to import 5 kilograms of more into the United States, and they had to intentionally join in that agreement.
Yes, but...
Does that not convey what you want it to convey?
No, because the court sort of divided this into sort of two questions for the jury. And one, what was the conspiracy? And we agree that at least initially, the judge made it clear that the objective of the conspiracy was the importation of cocaine in the United States. Now, part of the problem is, as he continued to discuss that, he used what the government calls shorthand, and then just continued to refer to unlawful or criminal or illegal conduct without continually reiterating that importation. Now, that itself wouldn't be a problem if they had gone on to talk about what the defendants needed to personally know or their personal mens rea. But when you start to say they don't have to know all of these details. I posit the question in my brief, and I submit the government has never answered it.
They had to intentionally join the agreement to export or to import five, it should be export, shouldn't it?
No, and import. Now, what makes it a crime is importing it into the United States.
They had to agree to intentionally join the agreement to import 5 kilograms or more into the U.S.
Right, but that doesn't say what they have to know in particular. In other words, if they intentionally join the conspiracy as helping FARC traffic drugs, produce them, or in the case of Mr. Martinez Vegas, transport them within Colombia or within Colombia to Venezuela, they might find that they in fact joined a larger conspiracy. But it doesn't say that they had to know all the details, and I suggest that one of the
case that's not an error to say they didn't have to know all the details, correct? It's only in the context here where you're saying that
yes,
or adversely on your
there is no question in our mind that had the judge given the instruction we asked for, so the jurors were told unequivocally they had to find this particular state of mind, then yes, all these other qualifications wouldn't have made any difference because it would have laid it out simply for the jury. But the government's asking you instead to say, well, we read between the lines, and sure, we said lots of things that could be contradictory, but surely the jury must have figured that out. And I suggest that this really hinges on what it means to talk about unlawful.
What's the citation that where your grievance is focused?
I beg your pardon?
What's the page at which the judge erred?
What's the specific statement that you're challenging?
Well, what we're challenging, of course, is a statement that he didn't give. And there are written pleadings, and I can find them at the break. There are written pleadings where I ask for this instruction. I don't believe the government is disputing that I ask for the instruction on mens rea.
Here's what he said, though. And this is at 17:29 and 30. If you find that the government has not proven beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant conspired to import any amount of cocaine or to manufacture and distribute any amount with the intent or knowledge that it would later be imported to the United States, then you should find the defendant not guilty. That's full, complete, and accurate.
Well, I respectfully suggest it's not complete because what I keep going back to is joining the conspiracy is one thing. And conspiracy law makes it clear that you can join a conspiracy on a pretty thin reed. You don't have to know all the details. And my question is...
That passage appears 5 pages earlier at 1725.
The passage you just cited?
No, the one that you're complaining about.
Right.
Saying you don't have to know all the details. But as he goes on, finally completes this section of the instructions, is to say if you don't find beyond a reasonable doubt that they have the knowledge or intent, then you must acquit.
Well, with all due respect, I guess I don't read it precisely that way. I read it with them.
At the break, or if you have one, take look
right.
At 1729 and 30.
Right, but I guess the point I'm trying to make is that it's the joining of the conspiracy that's the issue. And a jury could find, not realizing what the particular mens rea was, that they joined the conspiracy. And indeed, there were conspirators who knew where the drugs were going to the United States. But they didn't know. And my question that I posit in the brief, and I respectfully suggest the government never answered it, is what would make it unreasonable for a juror to believe that these defendants, in their respective fronts, joined the conspiracy, but were not aware of where the drugs were going? And therefore, they didn't have that particular mens rea on that particular element of the fence, even though they were otherwise perfectly aware of their unlawful conduct.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Manuel Rechereta. I represent Mr. Erminso Cuevas Cabrera. I'm here with my co-counsel, Mr. Gary Seidel, and we were both trial counsel at the trial in this case. Just picking up as Mr. Gilbert indicated the sufficiency of the evidence, just a brief mention for my client. And if I may, if I could have 2 minutes worth of rebuttal time with the permission of the court. With Mr. Cuevas, there were four witnesses really that were against him. There were two lab workers from the cocaine lab that were presented by the government. There was also a cooperating witness that was the witness that accepted the satellite phones that were discussed, that are discussed in the Title III issue that we have. And then also a another guerrilla that visited the lab where Mr. Cuevas was supposed to have operated and conducted the business. It is those four witnesses that are the point of the government's case against him. Absent those four witnesses, there is pretty much nothing against Mr. Cuevas, nothing specifically related to intent to import into the United States or tying to a cocaine lab. I don't want to just sweep away those four witnesses, but three of those witnesses were what were called Colombian reinsertados, which were witnesses that were previously guerrillas captured or submitted themselves to the Colombian army, and then as part of that, they were debriefed, they were reintegrated into Colombian society. However, they were still under the watchful eye of the Colombian government, and as we note in our argument related to the confrontation issue, they were actually tethered with a electronic monitor while they were here in the United States.
Wasn't it jury informed that they were all subject to prosecution?
They were all subject to prosecution. As an example, the woman, Maria Santiago, who was the cook at the lab, in her testimony testified that she did not think that she was subject to perjury here in the United States. So while there was a level of agreement with them and the Colombian government, they felt that they, well, I don't want to put words in, there was not that same tie to the United States and the prosecutors in this case.
You're conceding there were four witnesses that provided evidence as to the intended location of at least 5 kilograms of all this cocaine that was being produced. And you're making credibility arguments, which a jury certainly could have credited, but apparently did not. So I'm having trouble figuring out what, I don't think you're, are you saying anything to us as to credibility that the jury either didn't know about or could have been informed about?
No, I'm putting it in the most conservative fashion, because what they ended up saying was barely linking Mr. Cuevas to that lab, let alone knowledge of importation to the United States. Because it was Maria Santiago, the cook, who said that she saw him there. It was her brother who said he saw him there.
He was running the place, right? He was running the lab. He was the owner or at least supervisor of this lab, and it seems like all the lower level, or a lot of the lower level folks knew where it was intended, and there's evidence that higher-ups in the FARC knew where they wanted to get this, and they're making tons and tons and tons, and I think all we need to know is whether a reasonable jury could have found that 5 kilograms or more of that, of those tons and tons of cocaine that folks expected to go to the United States and had financial incentives to send to the United States was intended to go to the United States.
But the Colombian guerrilla who testified about his presence at that, not the worker, the one that would travel to, identified another person, a person by the name of Cura, translated as priest, who was the one that was running that lab. And the cooperator who accepted the satellite phones, the corroboration between the witnesses wasn't there. So while there was this structure of there was a lab and we think that this person is tied to that lab, each of those witnesses contradicted the presence of, the identification of our client as opposed to others who may have been operating or working in that lab.
So your argument is not so much their credibility as just that if you take them at their word, the evidence was not sufficient.
Yes, if you throw in credibility, we have huge issues in terms of the reinsertado status, their cooperation, their believability, or at least the jury's analysis of whether or not they have a motive to say something other than the truth. While I have some additional time, I want to turn to the prosecutorial issue, and that is the closing statement that was made by the prosecutors in this case. This court has addressed and heard other cases dealing with closing arguments specifically. And I'm saying that because some of the opinions and some of the cases deal with statements made by prosecutors, improper statements, but sometimes at the beginning of a case. In this case, the defense was dealing with all elements that were discussed in the Moore case, what we like to discuss as the Gray 1 case, because as Judge Millett is aware, there is a Gray 2 case where there were similar issues, but I'll refer to it as the Moore Gray 1 case. But that case gives us the elements that we should look to when we have such a closing that we think is out of bounds. We look to the closeness of the case, which is offshoot of our sufficiency argument, but the centrality of the issue that was discussed here. And what was happening here, we would argue, is that there was a direct attack on defense counsel. There was a direct attack on the defense, but that attack, rather than going towards the evidence, spilled over into the world of the defense counsel. We begin with a reference to...
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just have a setup question here, and that is the objection to this argument wasn't immediate. It was after a break. Is that correct?
Yes.
Do you know... it seems like there's unsettled law in the circuits as to whether that counts as sufficiently preserved or whether we apply plain error. Since it wasn't right at the time, and then there was a break, and then you came back, and so the judge couldn't immediately correct it right then and there. Do you have a position on that?
No, I don't know that. I refer back to the request that's made at the time. I mean, it's, you know, being trial counsel, I can say it was a strategic decision at that time, because certainly things are being said, and jurors are attentive, and you think, well, wait a minute, I don't want to pop up and say foul, 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 and have the jurors look at us as if we're crying wolf. Mm-hmm. So no, Your Honor, I do not know. I do not know that answer. But we do have the situation that Moore describes, and that is language, which inflames passion, which refers to a hometown of one of the prosecutors, and this is what ends up in my streets. That's not evidence in the case. Attempts to place the jurors in the shoes of the victims here, the witnesses here, and 8 separate instances that we were able to count where prosecutors stated, I don't buy it, and maybe you shouldn't buy it, and I don't think that's right. And as Moore indicated, anything that goes beyond a fact-based argument, anything that goes to something that is not supported by the evidence or inflames is something that needs to be examined. Our concern with this argument is the concern that we've had with other cases. There is a progression of these arguments, this style of arguing, that we feel needs to be at the very least identified, corrected. In this case, we feel that it took what was a weak government case and brought it into the shoes of the jury, who was feeling it, thinking about it on their streets, just as the prosecutor argued that it was on his streets in his hometown. And that's just not appropriate.
When you say this was a direct attack on defense counsel, and what you're referring to is the government lawyer's statement that I don't buy it or I don't agree, is that what you're
indeed,
referring to?
Indeed.
I mean, you don't think that could be viewed as just saying the evidence doesn't support that? Or?
Well, I like to think of what should be said. And what should have been said is the evidence was contradicted. The evidence, the weight of the evidence was not as much as you, as much as the defense argued it. There is other evidence which shows that this was not correct. I don't buy it, and you shouldn't buy it, because there was a you shouldn't buy it also, is, look, I'm the government counsel. I'm here protecting you from these Colombian guerrillas, and I don't think it's good. So maybe you should listen to me, because I carry the weight of the U.S. government when I'm arguing.
Except the court said he doesn't.
Exactly.
The court said that's not to be taken.
Oh, no, there's no corrective instruction. There was no corrective instruction there. We asked for something, and there was no corrective instruction.
It wasn't a standard instruction?
There was a standard instruction, but we objected, and that was denied.
You objected to them. You wanted more, but the standard.
Yeah. We objected to that was being said in there, which is another one of the more elements, which is what was done to correct what we just heard, and that was absolutely nothing in this case. And again, distinction with some of the other cases, this was at the very end, right before they walked back into the jury room. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Levy, and I represent the government on this appeal. I think I will just follow the order that my adversaries did and address the same issues in that same order. If I could start with the jury instruction, it was suggested that was the place to start because the standard review is more favorable to the defense on that. That is not true. For the jury instruction, what we're talking about here is a choice of language.
Did you object to their proposed jury instruction?
I believe we did, although I'm not.
Why? It would have clarified. This is, you know, complicated stuff for a jury to navigate through, and you have to admit that there were times when there was not the precision one would want from the district court judge in a big case like this. Why would you object? What were you afraid of?
I disagree that the language added anything, Your Honor. I think if you look through the charge and
is that a ground for objection?
It is a basis for not revising the charge, and I suppose I should be more certain that we did object and that it wasn't just that the judge rejected. I don't want to suggest that I'm certain here. I'm not positive, but I think an objection.
That instruction has been used in other the one that they asked for. It's not like something out of left field. It's been used by district courts in other cases precisely to add the clarity and to point the jury to the sort of precision of the two-part findings and determinations that they need to make.
But that precision was added, was there in the language. It may have been that this would have duplicated it.
Well,
I think certainly our best language, I think, certainly is what Judge Ginsburg was quoting earlier at, I think it's 1729. The jury was told point blank what they did and did not need to find in order to convict. And I would suggest that is just the very end of a series of instructions that, if anything, made the importation were repetitive with respect to how critical the importation element was. In the Martinez case, this court found that one of the reasons the instruction was fine in that case was because I think it was that five or six times the court had talked about importation, knowledge of importation in the United States. I went back and counted.
Back to 1729, because the problem is that right at the top of that page, you've got a couple of the what is necessary is that a defendant participated in the conspiracy with knowledge of its unlawful purposes. And you've got twice, right, right there. Potentially engage your advisor assistant for the purpose of furthering an illegal undertaking. So it's not as though the worrisome stuff is all five pages early. You've got it right there, back to back. And then we don't say don't find guilty. We say if you find this intent, you should find them guilty.
It actually does say don't find guilty. If you keep going to the next page, it says if, however, you find that they have not proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
Is it clear then, given what's said on the top of page 1729, is it clear on 1730 that the conspiracy has to have the intent or that they had to have the intent? I mean, I think that's their argument is...
I would argue it's perfectly clear that they had to have the intent. First of all, on 1729 and 1730, I think it's abundantly clear. I think if you look just at that, it couldn't be clearer that they have to have had the intent. And then even the part that Your Honor was just quoting, which talks about the knowledge of its unlawful purposes and with an intent to aid in the accomplishment of its unlawful objectives, there had been, and I counted again, 15 or 20 references, depending on how one counts, to the object being importation with knowledge that it would be imported, or manufacture with knowledge that it would be imported into the United States.
So your view of 1725, that the district court was essentially defining what the unlawful purpose and objectives were?
The district court, more than at 1725, as I said, the instruction was, if anything, repetitive in how often it went through, here is what the conspiracy is. If you go through 15 or 20 times, the district court actually says either, I think 15 times the district court says importation, knowledge of importation into the United States. Another 5 times it uses the shorthand knowledge of importation without actually following through and saying into the United States, but importation can only be the United States in this context. Then wraps it all up at 1729 and 30, saying exactly what was required. And if I could add one other fact that I think we didn't highlight as much as we should have in our brief, the summation on this point, the government in its own summation talked at first about 5 things that it argued were not in dispute, and then said there are really only 2 questions that are left in terms of what's in dispute, and this is at page 92 of the summation.
We rely on attorneys' summations. Are there cases that say if we were still unclear about whether the instructions passed muster, can we rely on attorney summations? Since my assumption is you're going to say on other issues in this case that attorney arguments aren't to be, are just arguments, and not the instructions that they should follow, and they're not evidence, and they're also not the instructions they should follow.
I certainly will be arguing that on other points, Your Honor. On this, I do believe there are cases. I don't have them at my fingertips, but for a harmlessness argument, if the court were to find that the instruction were erroneous, in terms of figuring out whether or not the jury could possibly have misunderstood this, the government in its summation, and to be clear, the government's position is there is nothing wrong with these instructions, mm-hmm. that they really were perfectly clear, and that the defense is quibbling about the language, and that was within the district court's discretion. But even if there were error in terms of harmlessness, the government said that there were 2 questions, and only 2 that were in dispute. First, were all the government witnesses lying when they said that Martinez, Vega, and Cuevas Cabrera were participants in the conspiracy? That doesn't have to do with this issue. And the second question, which is the subject of some dispute, and I'm quoting, and that is, did the defendants know that the cocaine was coming to the United States? So the government, in its summation, and then the government proceeded to address what the evidence showed on that, there was no misunderstanding.
So those were the only 2 issues?
The government, in its summation, suggested that those were the 2 issues, but the first one...
That was argumentative in itself. I mean, the defense had made an issue out of identification.
The first question encapsulated all that. The government said the first question in dispute is, are all of our witnesses lying when they say that these defendants were participants in the conspiracy? So it's all captured in that. Basically, did these guys do it? And then question number 2 is, did they have the appropriate knowledge? So the government had carved that out and made a whole point of that as being a significant dispute. It was not lost.
Said there's only 1 issue, are they guilty?
That would have been a shorter but less focused summation, maybe more focused. Unless there are further questions on the jury instruction, I'll turn for a moment to the sufficiency of the evidence. It sounded like my adversary was arguing a sufficiency claim that is different on behalf of Mr. Cuevas than was presented in the brief, which was that Mr. Cuevas, that there was insufficient evidence that he was even responsible for the lab. The evidence was overwhelming. I think defense counsel even conceded there were 4 witnesses who tied him to the lab. I think appropriately was not an argument that was even made in the brief. The sufficiency challenge that has been made is with respect to whether or not these 2 defendants knew that the drugs were, or that some quantity of the drugs, 5 kilograms or more of these thousands of tons of drugs, were coming to the United States. A couple of points that I would just call to the court's attention on that is to bear in mind that this is a conspiracy charge, of course. And so some of the cases that the defense relies on, although they may have been conspiracy charges as well, focused very much on a single load. That was the case to some extent in Martinez. It was certainly the case in Londano Villa. Those were cases where the question was, did the defendant know that a particular load was going to the United States? That's not the circumstance here. For sufficiency in a conspiracy case like this that covered years and covered thousands of tons of cocaine, where there was clear testimony that the United States was the predominant market for this cocaine.
And please tell me if I'm wrong, that because it struck me as a little, I couldn't quite figure out how to deal with this with our light most favorable context of looking at evidence at this point. When you have, I'm right, first of all, that all the jury had to find was that of those tons and tons and tons, at least 5 kilograms were aimed for the U.S.
That's correct. In fact, it didn't even have to have gotten here, although obviously it did.
Yes. And then you had a lot of overwhelming statistical evidence that the district courts recited as well. Do you know how one takes that in the light most favorable to the jury at this point? For statistics as opposed to, you know, do we look, if there's tons and tons and tons and some percentage, do we do some sort of mathematical breakdown to make sure that at some level there's...
I've
got to get five, you know, think that five would have gotten through?
I have a somewhat crude analogy that it may not hold up perfectly, but for how just the statistical analysis alone, leaving aside the specific evidence from witnesses.
Right.
But if you and I have an agreement to flip a coin, and the question is, did I know the coin was going to come up heads, mm-hmm. The answer to that may or may not be yes. Mm-hmm. If we agree to flip a coin 10,000 times, I know that the coin is going to come up heads. That is the situation that we
at
have
here. At least once.
At least once. That's the situation that we have here. These defendants were involved in a massive conspiracy to ship thousands of tons of cocaine, knowing that the United States was a regular destination.
I'm just trying to figure out that under that, sort of just the structural operation of FARC, its cocaine export business, the amount of cocaine coming from Colombia to the U.S., the fact that U.S. is such a prime market, could everybody that was involved at the laboratory from the lowest person on up be indicted for this same offense because they would all have the same basis for knowledge?
I think let me say that I'm not sure that's something that has to be decided in this case. What would differentiate people is their level of supervision, and that's something that this court in Martinez found to be significant.
Lower level workers here that actually were talking about it going to the U.S.
Certainly anybody who actually talked about it knew that it was going to the U.S. If you were to pluck a lower level worker who worked for some brief period of time in a lab and say, based purely on the statistics, that short term worker for 2 weeks knew that it was going to the United States, could a jury, would that evidence be sufficient for a jury to convict? It might be. Again, that's not the case. It might not be. That's not the case we have here, though. We have high-level defendants, high-level participants in this conspiracy who participated for years and years. And so the statistics take on a different meaning as to them. But it's not just about the statistics. We had individual witnesses who said, in effect, everybody knows. They couldn't testify to other people's knowledge, but they said it was talked about, it was a normal thing to talk about the drugs going to the United States, that the highest level FARC leaders like Mano Jojoy gave, this is a general commanding his troops essentially, gave the instruction that it was the policy of the FARC that the drugs would go to the United States.
And the lab that Mr. Cuevas is charged with operating, running, whatever title you want to give him. What I found very confusing, what years we're trying to cover with this indictment and conviction, because there'd be one thing in the indictment, another thing in the set of dates in the jury instructions, another set of dates in the new trial decisions by the district court. So how many years are we talking about? And what was your evidence, taking the light that was favorable to you? How much was coming out each year?
That's a fair question. I think I had by the week that it was in terms of how much was coming out. Mm-hmm. I don't have in front of me how many years specifically we proved Mr. Cuevas was running that lab. I think it was 1,000 kilograms a week was the number, if I remember correctly, for what the volume was.
At some point, it would just help me if I just get clarified. It doesn't have to be this minute on what the years were that you were talking about here for the amount of operation, both for him and as to Martinez Vega, because I found different dates almost everywhere I looked in trying to pin down the exact years of their issue here.
Would that be something, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to do it at the table or not, would that be something I could submit after the argument?
Mm-hmm.
I'd be happy to do that.
Like I said, the jury instructions the judge gave, a time frame didn't seem to match the indictment, and then the new trial decision had different dates.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it was a broad indictment also and covered a large number of people and a large number of fronts, and it was multiple years and a large conspiracy. I'd also note, as to Mr. Cuevas himself, there was testimony that he walked in on a conversation where there was specific reference to drugs going to the United States. So there's that even more specific level of detail as to him. There was also the money, that American money was being used routinely in millions of dollars, and that it was the only currency other than pesos that was around. And I'd like to call one citation to the court's attention to the extent it's useful on this issue of what everybody knows and what a jury can infer from that. This court's case in U.S. v. Gooch, 665 F3rd, 1318. And in that case, and we did not have that in our brief, and I apologize for that, but I found it the other day. In that case, the defendant was...
Did you tell the other side you were going to cite that argument?
I didn't. Frankly, I can drop it if Your Honor would prefer. A case in which this court held that a jury could infer that a defendant had heard the rumors that were floating around, which is essentially the same here. That if something is widespread enough, if there are enough widespread rumors, that the jury can infer that that's the case. It's an argument that was captured, I think, in Martinez anyways, that a high-level supervisor or, frankly, any participant can be, it is reasonable to infer that that person knows what everybody around them knows. If there are no other questions on sufficiency, I'll turn to the summation. I would note that as for the rebuttal summation and the use of I, that was taken appropriately by the jury as we submit. In no instance did the prosecutor ever say, I don't buy that, and then move on as though the jury was supposed to take his word for it. It might have been better to say we submit as opposed to I, but in context, I'd point out that nobody objected. Defense counsel, certainly, as they were sitting there, did not jump up and say this is improper and the prosecutor is vouching.
Don't prosecutors know they're not supposed to be using I?
I think prosecutors do know that. You heard my adversary stumble to come out with alternatives for explaining to the jury.
I didn't think he stumbled. I thought he had very good ones. The evidence shows. That's not what the evidence shows. This evidence showed. That one is said. There's nothing stumbly about that. That's how you're supposed to do it.
A couple of them sounded a little bit clunky to me, but I take Your Honor's point that there are better ways to do it than to say I over and over in this
context.
You're
not suggesting the prosecutor just have to say I to be smooth in their rhetoric, are you?
No. There are better ways to do it. I agree, Your Honor. In context, though, it wasn't the kind of thing the reason for not saying I is because it has the possibility of inviting the jury to take the prosecutor's word for it. If there had been any whiff of that happening here, defense counsel would have popped up and said that's not allowable. They didn't, and that's, for one thing, that's what leads to plain error review. But on top of that, it tends to indicate the way that the jury, in fact, would have taken it, the way that everybody in the room took it, because the prosecutor followed immediately with the list of reasons and in the evidence for why it was.
Do you have a view on the standard of review for the prosecutorial statement about my city, Detroit, like yours? And then there was just a short, it was a break. There were no intervening proceedings, but it wasn't contemporaneous. And unless I'm missing something, I didn't see anything in your brief, it's unclear to me exactly whether that counts as sufficiently preserved.
I'm not sure, Your Honor. As I said, I agree with you. In our brief, we did not argue that that's plain error review.
So
I think
we
under
just take that as given for this case.
I think for this case, given that it was the very end of the summation, and then the first thing before the jury came back, for purposes of this case, I'm not sure that it's the law, but we didn't argue that the standard matters very much here. There was no prejudice. Frankly, the argument, I think, was fairly responsive to what the defense had done in their opening, and I think we may have shorted ourselves a little bit in our brief on what it was responding to. In our brief, we say it was responding to this refrain by the defense that the prosecutors were from New York City. It's actually more than that. If you look at the full quotation, the refrain from the defense in the opening was, this is a case from Columbia that you shouldn't care about. The defense opening was, this is a case involving basically the Republic of Colombia, Colombian witnesses, with the exception of a very few prosecution
witnesses. There's plenty of ways to get past that without talking about, this is my hometown that's at issue, jurors. The prosecutor shouldn't be saying that.
I think it's a crime
committed against the United States of America, bringing massive amounts of drugs in here. Go on. I'm sure that they've got appropriate rhetoric to use at that point.
I think that's right, Your Honor. I think the Detroit part probably could have been left out. I suspect it was a response to say, I'm not a New York City lawyer, as I've been accused of being, to let the jury know that...
He was a New York City lawyer.
He's a New York City lawyer from somewhere else. I don't know if that's what he was trying to get across or not. There was certainly evidence that these drugs were flooding the United States and would have encompassed American cities. He drew his own as one of the three that he used as an example.
I agree, you shouldn't have done that.
I think throwing Detroit in was a mistake.
You're talking about his city, whichever it is.
Shouldn't be talking about his city, although I think he said where he was from.
Personalizing it that way.
The personalizing, I think saying New York City and District of Columbia, since New York City had been raised by the defense and District of Columbia is where we are, I think that was appropriate. And my city, Detroit, that would have been best left out. This court has always deferred to the district court's judgment on whether or not there was any impact from that. I'm sorry, I see I'm over my time. If I could just finish the question and then I'll sit down. This court has always deferred to the district court on what the impact would be, and the district court here immediately said it was a single remark at the end of a very long trial that had focused exclusively on a drug conspiracy, as had the summation, and that the jury could not have been swayed by a single remark like that. Thank you.
Thank you.
I promise I'm going to address that instruction, Judge Ginsburg, but may I have just a moment to talk about statistics? Because the statistics you have to look at are not if you have a kilogram of cocaine in the United States at this time, it was 90% likely that it came from Colombia. Rather, the statistic is if you have a kilogram of cocaine in Colombia, there's a 50-50 chance it's going to the United States. And then if you look at the geographical distribution, I suggest that if there's cocaine being transported or produced in the eastern part of Colombia, that percentage goes up even more.
We have tons and tons and tons and tons and tons being produced over years and years and years and years and years, and we just have to say, what could a reasonable jury have found that five kilograms of that was targeted for the U.S. hope to get there?
Actually, Your Honor. Now this is dealing with Martinez Vega, all of the sort of conspirators, the distributors that FARC provided the drugs to, all were from Brazil or Suriname. And in fact, the one person that testified that he directly got drugs from Martinez Vega said, I told him they were going to Suriname. And Suriname, if you look at that chart,
drugs from Colombia to Brazil would end up in the U.S., maybe not the majority. But
actually, if you look at that chart, the vast majority of drugs coming out of Brazil.
The vast majority, fine. But again, we've got tons and tons and tons over years. We only need five.
You have to talk about what cocaine Martinez Vega or Mr. Cuevas were involved in. At any rate, my point is the statistics are not looked at from the point of view of cocaine once it's arrived in the United States. Rather, it's cocaine in Colombia. Judge Ginsburg, with respect to the instruction at the end, I think there's a couple of problems with it. First of all, it starts off with thus, and that certainly is a reference, I think, to the language that comes before. And on those pages, the rest of that page, 729, 728, that's where you... It's at the beginning of the sentence. You referred me to at the very bottom of 729. That's the instruction that says, you know, if you should find him guilty, and then the next 730 is when you say you should find him not guilty. One of it is the thus, and if you look at all those paragraphs before that, those are all the ones that limit, that narrow down what a defendant has to do to be part of a conspiracy. My second point would be... Huh?
Is this a jury of 12 lawyers?
No, that's precisely my point, because they wouldn't have known that unlawful in this case meant unlawful in the laws of the United States of America, not Colombia.
You think the thus is the key here?
No, I'm saying that's one of it. Because the problem is that this instruction, sort of comes in there at the end. It is inconsistent, I suggest, with everything the judge has told them immediately preceding. But
what follows is exactly what you want. 1730.
No.
And then that's explicated with reference to intent or knowledge.
With all due respect, well, first, it's the use of this word conspired, because the judge has previously broken that up. Said you have to show the existence of a conspiracy, and then the defendant joined the conspiracy. And, of course, the defendant's mens rea only applies to that second question. We didn't dispute there was a conspiracy, at least at the upper levels, to distribute and to the United States. But when you're talking about conspire here, I think what's happening is the judge is ramming them together, and I don't see anything in that that is necessarily inconsistent with the argument that the conspiracy the defendant joined was to import, but that that was one of the details of the conspiracy the defendant did not know. The one little, and I'm sure Mr. Rettereto may want to address this, actually that instruction with respect to Martinez Vega is even more problematic, because it talks about finding the defendant conspired to import any amount of cocaine or to manufacture any amount of cocaine. And the indictment, of course, yes, but the indictment actually talks about manufacture or distribute. The problem is that there's no allegation that I think Mr. Martinez Vega manufactured.
Last point, what's the problem with the indictment?
No, it's not a problem with the indictment. The charge is the alternative. It's to intend to distribute, or it's to manufacture or distribute with the intent or knowledge. And it's in the alternative, and the jury can find in the alternatives, and we don't have a quarrel with that. But here he leaves out the second distribution. And for Mr. Martinez Vega, you know, he's not really telling them. He's really sort of telling them that nothing about the intent or knowledge. I'm sorry. What he's saying here, because Mr. Martinez Vega didn't manufacture any cocaine. All right, he's the transporter of cocaine. It just says manufacture, not manufacture or distribute.
It's better for you. It's manufacture and distribute.
In the indictment, not in this instruction at this point.
Here it says, or to manufacture and distribute.
In the not guilty, but in what he's telling them in the paragraph immediately before that you said, referred me to. And the problem is that has the knowledge element.
What about 1717? That is, the government must prove that defendant knowingly associated himself with others in the conspiracy, that's number one, and participated in the conspiracy to import cocaine into the United States, knowing or intending that it would be imported into the United States. Even get manufacture and distribute again.
Well, you know, I understand the argument that somehow that can be construed as an explicit statement of the defendant's mental state. I respectfully suggest, given the other instructions that the judge has given about the defendant does not have to know all the details, that they can conclude, a juror could reasonably have concluded that Mr. Martinez Vega or Mr. Cuevas entered into a conspiracy. That conspiracy happened to be one to import into the United States, but that was a detail of the conspiracy that they did not know. And for that reason, we believe the instruction was faulty.
Briefly, if I may, regarding the closing argument, the example of, I think the best example of a prosecutor taking an argument and pointed it at a defense counsel, an officer of the court, came in this case with the PowerPoint slide that was presented. And the PowerPoint slide was a slide that talked about one of the witnesses, in this case the cook that was at the lab, the female, and how the defense had objected to some of her testimony, which, if I'm correct, dealt with her listening to conversations in the lab. In the PowerPoint slide that was presented at closing, there was specific mention made that this was brought into the case over defense objection. Now, take away PowerPoint, take away technology. There's no district court judge that would allow a defense attorney or a prosecutor to say, hey, this is really good evidence, and you heard opposing counsel object to it, and the judge gave it the okay, so you should really listen to this. The PowerPoint slide is a perfect example of that, except it's not an argument made. It's, look at my PowerPoint, this is a good witness, and you have that little factor at the end.
What's the prosecution supposed to do, though? By putting in ellipsis right between the key question and the key answer, it might cause the jury to be confused and think the government's leaving something out. So they just said, look, here's the verbatim transcript. There's nothing inflammatory. Objection overruled for the same reasons. That's all that's reproduced there. Why isn't that acceptable?
Because because we wouldn't be able to say it verbally.
Say what verbally?
We wouldn't be able to tell the court, hey, we wouldn't be able to tell the jury, we had that question, this was the answer, and even though there was an objection, that answer stood. If we were to argue to the jury, we would be saying that. If we were to argue to the jury what that PowerPoint... Again,
what's the government supposed to do? They, for obvious reasons, they don't want to put an ellipsis in.
Remove it.
But they want to... No, this is the key testimony. Did you ever hear people at the laboratory discussing where the cocaine was going? Yes, they said it was being taken to the United States. I think I can understand why the government wanted to put that up on a slide in front of the jury. And so there are two options, were to reproduce it as it was in the PowerPoint slide or to throw an ellipsis in through the objection. But the objection was on record. The jury had already heard it. And for an ellipsis, for obvious reasons, can
but
the jurors go, what are they leaving out?
But what they're leaving out is what should not be there. We should not be discussing whether or not a judge accepted or denied an objection.
No one's discussing it. They're just reproducing what the jurors already heard.
But I would argue the jury shouldn't be submitted to that. Because if I were to say that rather than present a PowerPoint slide, the judge and prosecutor would say, objection. What are you talking about an objection before, whether it was sustained or overruled?
That was on the record, was it? In front of the jury?
Yes. I see my time is up. Thank you.
By the way, is the slide in the materials you provided? I did not see it.
I don't know. I don't know if we have that in the appendix.
Is it available to you?
I believe we may have it in our
record. Your colleague behind you, yes.
If I could speak out of turn, Your Honor, we were asked for that earlier in the week and supplied it to the court, so it's in somebody's chambers.
Thank you.
Okay. So we can start with the individual issues.
Yes. Now I'd like to address three individual issues involving Mr. Martinez-Vega. Perhaps again, if I could reserve a couple, 2 minutes, let's say, for rebuttal. I'd like to first of all talk very briefly about the sentencing issue because I think it's the most finite issue. And that has to do with the question of whether or not the government had to prove, in order to get the enhancement as a manager supervisor, whether the government had to prove that the participants had the same mens rea. And I suggest that's what the case law in this jurisdiction says, and that mens rea in this case, if we've just been arguing about, certainly is that they would have also had to know or intend that the drugs are going to the United States. And, of course, there's absolutely not a shred of evidence that the people that worked on the boats with Mr. Martinez would have known anything about that. The government in its brief makes what I think is a relatively novel argument at page 94 that, well, they don't have to have participants. It's enough if the conspiracy is an extensive one. And as I tried to argue in my reply brief at page 38, that's not the law here. You still need to have a participant. And a participant as defined in the law is someone that shares the same mens rea. So in our view, the trial judge erred as a minimum in computing the sentencing guidelines. The question of a minor role in a huge, you know, conspiracy encompassing the entire nation is another issue that's been before the court on another case I have, and undoubtedly will come up again on others I have when you bring these indictments that charge entire cartels or entire terrorist groups. If I can talk about, unless you have questions.
I think your brief had said they had to have the exact same mens rea. They had to, that the subordinates would have to know or intend that the cocaine be headed for the United States. And I thought our cases said otherwise, and that it's enough that they have some culpability in the charged crimes, but it doesn't have to be the exact same mens rea or crime, that maybe even just producing cocaine would be sufficient.
Well, with all due respect, Judge, I don't read your cases that way. I mean, I think they talk about the same mens rea, and the mens rea in this case, I mean, yes, if you could show that
if they were aiding and abetting,
they still have to have the mens rea, though.
That one, or they were just another participant. They were involved in culpable conduct as part of the conspiracy. So they were, like I said, manufacturing cocaine. Why would?
But
that
what
be
makes them culpable for a charge in this courthouse is either the intent or the knowledge to import cocaine into the United States.
In this case, that's all it.
Yes. Now, I mean, if the government could have shown that Mr. Martinez intended the drugs to go to the United States and the workers only knew the drugs were going to the United States, I'm sure that would be sufficient. But of course, we have absolutely no knowledge whatsoever as to what.
In U.S. versus BAPAC, it is enough that the participants she supervised were culpably involved in uncharged crimes that were part of the same course of conduct or common scheme or plan as the offense of conviction. So that wouldn't require that they have the import intent.
Well, it's a novel issue, Your Honor. I think the plain language of the other cases I've cited is that they need to have the same mens rea. It's a novel issue, and you may conclude to the opposite, but I respectfully suggest that what makes this a crime that's punishable in the United States of America is this whole importation, and that participants have to share that. If they're just simply violating the law in Colombia, that's unlawful conduct, but it's not unlawful in the United States of America. I do want to talk about the two issues concerning the government's false testimony by Agent Garrido and the question about the photograph involving Angel Leopoldo Lopez. With respect to Garrido, I hope I don't have to make an argument that one of Garrido's two instances of testimony was false. The question that I think that we have really is, okay, it was false. We now know it's false because out of the presence of the jury, but after he already testified before the jury, Garrido admits he has absolutely no recollection whatsoever of what he had just testified to that morning. The question then becomes, what's the remedy? The government wants to argue, well, Mr. Gilbert, you found out belatedly, but you found out that he didn't know this, and so it's your responsibility to call him back to the stand. And I respectfully suggest that that's not the case. The government doesn't get a pass just because they don't raise an issue on direct examination. with their agents, because this is testimony about the agent's conduct of the investigation. In that sense, he's still the government's witness. Let me give you an example. The Jinks Act, for example. The Jinks Act says you don't have to give the defense the statements of a witness until after the witness has testified on direct examination. The implication is that if I get a statement that directly contradicts what the witness says, then I get, you know, now I have it, and now I get to say, okay, but isn't it true that you said this to the special agent? And if the witness does, like Ms. Ortiz did about everything else, I don't remember, then the implication is that I then get to call the special agent to say, didn't she tell you that? The government doesn't get a pass so that that agent is free to come in and lie about that. They're the ones that have met with him. They're the ones that have talked with us about it.
Aren't these things satisfied as long as you get to bring the information out on cross-examination? Is there any obligation in your hypothetical for the government to stand up and say, our person was lying, as opposed to you bringing it out on cross-examination? I thought that was a district court's point here.
No, what I'm trying to say, and just analogizing to the Jinks Act, is that I think the implication is there will be times when the defense has to call the government agent in order to make use of the Jinks material, because the witness is denying it or claiming not to remember. Mm-hmm. My argument is when I do that, as I did in this case with respect to other aspects of Ms. Ortiz's testimony, he's still the government agent testifying about his investigation of the case. He doesn't get a pass to lie.
I understand that. No one says anybody gets a free pass to lie in court, especially not government witnesses or government officials. But the question that you said, you teed it up, is what is the remedy here? And does the Constitution require that they get up and say mea culpa, or submit a stipulation to the jury that says mea culpa, or is it sufficient under the Constitution that you have the information about the credibility problem and that you have every opportunity to wring it out of the guy?
Well, you know, that's I do believe the first part of your question is that, no, I believe that they're required to correct the false testimony. All right? And so they could have done it by a stipulation. I proposed a stipulation. They rejected it, and Judge Hogan didn't make them do it. That's why I cited in my 28J letter the Straker case, which decided by this court, in which you found an instance of false testimony was not a harmful error, precisely because a jury teed it up, the stipulation teed it up for the jury to understand and teed it up for the government, for the defense counsel to argue.
That's certainly a way of remedying it. I think what you have to do to prevail, if I'm wrong, is give us a basis for holding that the Constitution requires that route, stipulation route, or government standing up in court and confessing the problem, and it is not sufficient under the Constitution if you're given the information, time, and opportunity to bring the information out yourself.
Well,
I just didn't see cases saying that part
right.
of it, and it's, I understand why one might want to say the government has to take ownership of its lying officials, but I didn't see cases saying that remedy is constitutionally compelled.
Well, I think that's because that's what's assumed to be the remedy. That's the language that the Supreme Court has used all the way from NAPU down, the government's obligation to correct. But I think there's two problems that's worth talking to very briefly. One, the chronology here is different than before. That's because the government did not disclose this purported identification. So we have a hearing on it, only on Ortiz's identification, only after Garrido gets on the stand and says, yes, it happened. And so all of a sudden, I'm at least entitled to a suppression hearing. And sure enough, at the suppression hearing, after he's already been on the stand, then all of a sudden I learn that Garrido has testified. Now, he's already off the stand now. All right. This is now speaking as a trial lawyer. And you know, I just hope you'll understand this if you haven't been in these shoes. You do not want to call as your witness, if you don't have to, someone like Frank Garrido. Because Frank Garrido has already shown, you're going to hear about this whole Mencho business. You saw in his testimony that Garrido slips in that he got the photographs from the Bureau of Prisons. Now, that's not even true, but I didn't want to emphasize that because he was in the custody of the marshals. But that's that Garrido was an extremely treacherous witness. If I have to call him, I can't cross-examine him. I have to ask him non-leading questions. And the government, who's the one meeting with him, not me,
I'm going to confess my lack of experience as a trial lawyer. Don't you get to say, can I treat him as hostile and then engage in the type of cross-examination type questioning that you want to?
If I'd been able to persuade the judge of that, maybe. But, you know, that's a discretionary ruling, and we weren't getting a lot of those. And if he rules against me...
You didn't ask for it here either.
Huh? No, I didn't, because I didn't want Garrido near the stand again as my witness. I couldn't trust him. I didn't know what he was going to say. And the government could, on cross-examination, get who knows what out. You know, I confused it because I was thinking of other witnesses that identified your client that we just didn't bring up here. Well, objection, and they've heard that already. The government is the one that controlled Garrido. The government's the one that knew what the truth was. I mean, we now know based
they
on post.
They learned it when you learned it.
What?
They learned it when you learned it.
No, with all due respect, Judge, I think they knew it before. Because if you
look. What's in the record on that?
Huh? I'm going to explain to you why you can infer that. All right, we now know in the end, you know, in the post-trial motions, the government basically takes the position that Garrido had no recollection. So, you know, as you sit here, the government in its post-trial pleadings basically said the truth was Garrido didn't know, didn't remember. All right? But look at what happened at the time Garrido says, I believe I did. Now, that was a huge surprise to me, because remember, the government had proffered after the surprise identification by Ortiz, which they had never proffered before.
Maybe I'm misrecalling this. I thought that the next day the government reported to the court that it just seems that he just has no recollection one way or the other.
I don't recall that. I recall, but this is what I do recall, Your Honor. In fact, you all asked for the transcript of the motion hearing that happened the day before the court. You might have asked for it for a different reason. But we're having a motion hearing about suppressing a brand new identification, which is Garrido and Ortiz and Para Diaz looking at the boat across the car across the river video, as if that's an identification they're making for the first time. So even on that day, it's not disclosed to us that both of these witnesses are later going to testify, oh no, I identified something in Bogota. So it came as a complete surprise when Ortiz gets up and says, oh no, I identified your client as Chiguero in the office with Agent Garrido. Complete surprise. I go to the government and say, whoa, you never disclosed this. What's this coming from? The government tells me, we don't have any records of that. That's what they're saying. Now, presumably they talked to Garrido. They had an obligation under the judge's orders to tell us about identifications. So presumably they go back and talk to Garrido. And they make a representation, careful representation, that they have no records. All right, I make the assumption that means they can't show that it happened. Then Garrido gets up and says, I believe I did. And I, of course, pop up and I say, can we come to the bench? Where's this coming from? And that's when the government says to me, well, go ahead and cross-examine him. I think that'll be clear. And I say, well, okay, fine, I'll do that. And then, of course, then I ask him directly, and he answers directly, and we go through a whole series of unequivocal answers about how he conducted that and what photographs were shown. I believe at that point I probably should have been aware. I certainly was suspicious. But did I know at that time that Garrido was going to testify subsequently under oath that he had no recollection whatsoever about that? Because if that's what he says, and he says it in front of the jury, that's a huge asset for me, because then I can argue to the jury, look, it didn't happen. Because if it had happened, Garrido would have remembered it. But that's not what he does in front of the jury. I think the question that you need to confront, and I guess we're not going to get to Leopold Lopez, the question you have to confront is when that happens. And it happens, the I don't remember anything happens after he's already been before the jury, then whether or not the responsibility is still on me to have to call this problematic witness back when it is truly, in our view, and under the case law, the government's responsibility.
I'll start, if I may, with the issue that we just left off on. There are a couple points to be made here. First of all, it's not at all clear. Actually, let me start with a different part on that. Special Agent Garrido's testimony, it is not at all clear, was false. It may well be that he did, in fact, show photos.
I believe I gave her some pictures, and then as soon as the jury said, I go, I don't know.
It's true.
Really? You're not defending that?
Oh, I'm not saying that his testimony was, I guess I'm saying that his testimony itself was not false, in the sense that the actual fact at issue here, whether or not Ortiz was shown photos, she very likely was. His testimony was not just, he said, I have no specific recollection of having shown photos to her, but I was showing photos to everyone, was his testimony. Her testimony is, I was shown photos. She actually didn't say who showed them to her.
It just struck me as, Mr. Garrido, time and again in this case, shows up and just miraculously says whatever it is the government seems to want. This helps the government's case at that time, and he's done it a couple of times in this case. And this one is outrageous to go up there and say, yeah, I think I did it to a jury, when he said he knew that he had no actual recollection of what he'd done.
I think, frankly, his memory evolved on it, and I think the record reflects that the government learned about this at the same time the defense. This is not a witness who was prepped on this.
I've got that. You all didn't call him, at least. That's good.
Right. We didn't call
him. Maybe you all, for good reason, weren't calling him on this issue. The question then is, you know, it's not like the government wasn't doing anything. Ortiz was your witness. You drew out this question. You got her to say that, yes, she'd got, see, I don't mean you personally. I can't remember who handled what, but the government got her to say, talk about this identification.
We didn't actually. I believe that came out from the defense.
That was only defense. Okay.
I think it was defense questioning. I think they anticipated the answer, no, I've never made any other ID. I'm just doing the one here in court. And they got the answer, oh, no, I was shown some pictures.
So what is going on with this whole thing, though, that, I mean, ordinarily, you know, identifications, there's a lot of procedures that go around identifications. There's a recognition that identification either helps the government or helps the defense. You keep records of these things. There's all these rules about who's supposed to be in the array. And there's plenty of other times in this case when arrays were done the right way and records were kept. And then it seems, why is it that suddenly you have the situation where all these IDs are being done and none of the rules are being followed?
I think the answer to that is because these were arrays being done at a very early stage for a very different purpose. This wasn't a bank robbery where you have a victim and you're showing an array and you're having the victim circle if there's a an identification. There was testimony from two other agents. I think the first one was Medina and the second was Dyer, and this happened out of the presence of the jury, where they explained what was going on. An agent in New York had a photo array created that involved this defendant's photo, and this is an array that the defense has. They've been given the array itself. It was provided and kept on file in Columbia, and any time that the DEA got access to one of these reinsertado witnesses for the first time, they would show them the array to see what they knew, to see, is this somebody who knows anything useful that we care about? Do you recognize anybody in here? And if they said yes, the testimony from these two agents was, okay, great, hold tight, somebody from the DEA is going to fly up here, fly down here and talk to you at some point. It wasn't being done for the purpose that would create the records that Your Honor's talking about or the defense is talking about. Could it have been done that way? I suppose, but it was for a different procedure at a much different stage of the investigation. On that subject,
just to be clear, then, so there was times, because then there was testimony about these arrays being evidence being shredded, these arrays being shredded, and files, case files, material in case files being shredded.
But again, I think that was a copy of an array they already had that hadn't been marked. So in the sense that there is this array in New York, there's this array in Columbia, it's being shown to people and then just put back in the file, shown to people, put back in the file. Especially in Garrido said he showed it to a number of witnesses. It was his routine practice to say, you know anybody in here. Special Agent Medina said the same thing. He would just show it to people and then phone back to New York and say, hey, this person knows, for example, Martinez Vega, you should talk to her. Put back in the file. At some point, the one that was in the file got shredded. But it was not marked. It was not.
It would be valuable, though, for a defense. If you're in an ongoing investigation, I'm sure this must have been a massive investigation, if the people said no, and then you continued to use them anyhow, isn't that something that government agents should be keeping track of?
That I don't know. That doesn't present itself in this case, and I take Your Honor's point on that, that if there had been a failure of an identification, that might be something that an agent should have made a note of. This person failed to identify.
How do we know? How do we know who she picked on the array? How do we know?
We don't.
We don't have that array, so how do we know?
I mean, she says she identified him. We know because she knows him, and Judge Hogan said this is somebody who had encountered the defendant numerous times, knew him well. There was
Did she ID him in the courtroom, too?
She ID'd him in the courtroom.
Okay.
The
but as a matter of practice in here, this seems very troublesome or worrisome to me that there are federal agents treating identification processes, which are, as they point out, good for you or good for us. There's sort of no in between on this. It's going to be helpful if we need to keep records of these things for a reason, even if you don't think you'll need to use them affirmatively as part of your case because they'll do an in-court ID.
I agree, Your Honor. I think it might be a better practice for them to have at least kept a note that somebody had been identified or not been identified, that sort of thing. But it doesn't present itself.
You need the array, right? They need to know. You could have an array with arrows all pointing to one person saying this is the guy, or everybody else looks nothing like him. I mean, there's all kinds of problems with arrays.
I suppose that's right, although the arrows would only be as good as the testimony of the agent who would say we didn't do that. Years later.
Well, not if it's shredded.
We have the array. Well, even if we had the array, we have the array that the agent hands over and says this is the array I used. Mm-hmm. So it's only as good as mm-hmm. the credibility of the agent. And Judge Hogan credited these agents. This is not a case that involves issues like that, though. The fact that, for example, Ms. Ortiz had identified the defendant when she was first...
I think you were near the end of your time, but given that untimely interruption, we'll give you a couple more minutes to collect your thoughts.
Thank you, Your Honor. I hope not to need much extra time, if any. I'd like to come back just to the issue of Special Agent Garrido. Actually, he may not be a special agent. I think he was an intelligence analyst. Because I think he may have gotten a little bit of a bum rap in terms of how his testimony developed. And Your Honor had suggested that he seemed to say what the government wanted at any particular time. I think that's not an accurate characterization of how his testimony came out. He was called as a defense witness on this point. And it had, I don't think there's anything in the record suggests he was prepped or had his memory refreshed on the subject of whether he had ever shown Ms. Ortiz photographs. And Ms. Ortiz, in her testimony, had not specifically said that Mr. Garrido was the one. So there's no reason anybody would have gone back and asked him about that. And he said at first, I think I did. And as he subsequently explained, the reason he thought he did is because he was showing photographs to everybody. And then when pressed on it further, said, yes, I did show her photographs. There's nothing from that.
I believe I did?
I think initially he said, I believe I did. And then after this sidebar to discuss everybody's surprise on that, he said, he was asked the question, so you showed her photographs, and he said, yes. Then later on the stand in front of the district judge with no jury there, having had his memory refreshed, having the government having had gone back to him on that subject, gave perfectly accurate and responsible testimony as he did the first time. It just caught him by surprise. I don't think that's at all unusual.
Well, I believe I did. I had a copy of the photo array depicting your client.
Yes.
That's a bit more specific.
But that's all true. He said he did have a...
But it's specific. It's not just, maybe.
And I think even by the time his testimony developed in front of Judge Hogan, I think it would be fair to say, to characterize it as his saying he believes he did, that he was showing it to everybody, but he had no specific recollection. His initial testimony in front of the jury was actually fully consistent with that. He was, I think, overly certain when the question was put to him a second time, and he just said, yes, I did show her photographs. I would submit that's not uncommon for a witness who has been caught by surprise on something that happened years ago. He got it wrong in the sense that he was not that certain as it ultimately developed. I don't think he got it wrong in the sense that he never showed Ms. Ortiz photographs. The record is that Ms. Ortiz says she was shown photographs by somebody
And Mr. Garrido said, I showed them to everybody, essentially. I just don't have a specific recollection.
Yes, although then there's in the testimony, he goes on to say, I didn't show this one, I didn't show this one, I didn't show this one.
I think there were some.
Not consistent with everybody.
That's true. He didn't say everybody, but he said he was showing them routinely. And so that, and he explained that was the basis for my answer that I showed it to Ms. Ortiz, is because that would have been consistent with my practice. So I think it's just the way the question caught him by surprise as a defense witness. On the subject of his being a defense witness, I don't think there was any need to convert him over to a hostile witness and start asking cross questions. He was already subject to being cross-examined by the defense. He had been called by the defense, but he was associated with the government. And so they were free to ask cross-examination questions from the get-go, much less if they'd wanted to call him back. They could have asked very tightly controlled cross-examination questions. It's also worth noting that they never even asked for the remedy that they're asking for now, which is to have the government call him back. As far as I'm aware, they never said, okay, it shouldn't be us, it should be the government. It just escaped after Mr. Garrido testified. I believe that was the end of it until there was a mistrial motion. I don't think there was a request.
How much later was the mistrial motion?
I'm sorry?
How much later was
it? I think it was mid-trial when Mr. Garrido was still available, but I don't think there was any point where they said the government, he has just testified, we've heard that he said something different, we would like that to come out, we would like the government to do it. I don't think they would have been...
Is that the stipulation then? Because there were a lot of these photo array issues. What was it they
the
said?
The stipulation...
Anything other than mistrial or this... Do they want a stipulation?
I think the stipulation went to the photo of the supposed other Chigiro.
Okay.
And not on this. I don't believe there was a stipulation, or at least a serious one, that was ever offered. In any event, I think the cases are clear that this, if it's a circumstance where, well, first of all, the testimony wasn't necessarily false. It was just more certain of its truth than was probably warranted. But he may well have shown Ms. Ortiz photos. Second, the government certainly didn't know it was false. It discovered the truth of the matter at the same time the defense did. There is no case the defense can point to that says in that circumstance it's not good enough under the Constitution for the defense to be permitted to call the witness back and ask the question. If I could turn to the sentencing, which is the other point that my adversary discussed. I don't know the answer, Your Honor, to your question about whether or not culpability for purposes of a participant involves hitting every element of the conspiracy itself. I think the guidelines aren't especially clear on whether someone can be culpable and therefore a participant without being fully guilty of the charged conspiracy that the defendant was charged in. I don't think it matters much here. The judge,
it does stand to reason, though, doesn't it? I mean, if the person is a subordinate with respect to the crime charged, then presumably the one would expect and perhaps require that they have shared in the same mental state.
I think that's right, Your Honor. I think I think that if you're talking about supervising other members of the conspiracy, it could be reasonable to read the guidelines as saying that it's required that at least one of those people being supervised is a conspirator, is a part of the conspiracy with the mental state that's required. I don't think it matters here because it's so clear that it was satisfied.
Can you help me then on with respect to Martinez-Vega? I know you had evidence submitted to the jury about his sort of high-level status. Can you point me in the record to the evidence that there was someone who was a subordinate who knew, as you've just said, well, except for this case, I had the intent and knowledge and participated in all the elements of this crime? Because your brief said, it was clear in the record, CEG, and both sides are to Cuevas. And so I don't know what specific evidence, and there it's, you've got an employment situation, so it's a little bit easier. What evidence did you give to the jury specifically that one could cite for you meeting this strict standard?
I don't think we had, first of all, I'm not sure it's that strict a standard, but I'll get to that in a second. I don't think we had specifically, I think it is true that for Martinez-Vega, we didn't have an individual who was subordinate to him who either testified or was testified about specifically, who was identified. So we're not relying on that. We are relying on circumstantial evidence, including that numerous low-level employees throughout the organization testified, FARC guerrillas and a cook in the cocaine lab, and everybody said, American Money was around. We knew it was going.
But it had to be the people he was charged with supervising.
It did. And
it
we
can't be that you had a lot of people talking generally about his stuff.
So wasn't he charged with supervising the Santiagos?
That's Cuevas, and I would say this is a much easier case for Mr. Cuevas, because we actually had somebody who he supervised who said, I knew the drugs were going to the United States. I don't want to suggest that we have that for Mr. Martinez-Vega. What we have is the expert testimony that the FARC's drugs go to the United States in huge volume, and then specific testimony from numerous people at all levels of the FARC organization who talk about how normal it was to have discussions about it, how openly it was discussed, how it was discussed by Mano Jojoy, again, this general down to the troops, explaining it to everybody. From that, Judge Hogan did not commit clear error in finding by a preponderance of the evidence, the standard being reduced for purposes of sentencing, that at least one of the many people that Mr. Martinez-Vega supervised while transporting, while on this expedition.
When I said higher standard, I didn't mean beyond preponderance for sentencing. What I meant was that you have stipulated for these purposes that they had to show that there was someone that he superintended that knew or intended that this cocaine was going to the U.S. And I think these sort of vague generalities without identifying whom you say he superintended and how we know that those people were aware of all this. Because I think we said earlier there could very well be a lot of people running around who just, I'm low-level folks, I'm just moving stuff in a boat. And I don't know. I don't know that much about FARC. I'm just a subsistence-level farmer or something here in the rural lands of Colombia. I just don't know this. Unless your position is that sort of anybody who touched the FARC conspiracy had to know, had no or intend, which is a pretty high mens rea.
So I think that there was some specific evidence as to, again, not the identities of specific people that Mr. Martinez-Vega supervised, but the group of them. One example of that is on this expedition where Mr. Martinez-Vega and another individual went off and killed two members of a lab and took, I think it was 1,000 kilos of cocaine. And Judge Hogan specifically relied on this at sentencing. Mr. Martinez-Vega was described by the witness as having troops, essentially, having his people who came with, who did this thing with him, and then who helped him move the cocaine to another place. We don't have the identities of those people, but it was sufficient by a preponderance, and again, it wasn't clear error for Judge Hogan to have made the decision. The people who are involved in that level of activity for the FARC, who are going off and participating in killing people and moving FARC guerrillas, not a cook at a lab who incidentally admitted she knew it was going to the United States and that everybody talked about it, but actual FARC guerrillas, who were going with Martinez-Vega under his control to do this thing and then carry away the drugs, that at least one of them knew that the drugs were going to the United States for purposes of preponderance of the evidence, and again, this court's clear error review of Judge Hogan. There were other circumstances where Mr. Martinez-Vega was supervising people. It was mostly involved in the transportation of drugs, either on the boats, or I think there was time when he came through with a group of people on trucks. The idea that all these people described as working for Martinez-Vega, not a one of them, can we conclude by a preponderance of the evidence, knew that drugs were going to the United States, when that fact is patently obvious, as described by the expert testimony. It is clear that the United States is the predominant market for Colombian cocaine. The idea that none of those people knew is not plausible, and it's certainly not clear error for Judge Hogan to have come out the other way.
Just remind me, in your brief, did you contest the appellant's position that the subordinate, at least one subordinate, had to have the same mens rea?
I don't think we contested it. We speak to some extent about otherwise extensive, and I'm not sure we were very specific about what we meant by that. I think it is correct that otherwise extensive is a replacement for having five or more culpable participants. I don't think it's a replacement for having at least one person who was a culpable participant be supervised by the defendant. So I don't think if you had the defendant...
What about the mens reas?
And that's my point, is that if you had only otherwise extensive, but not a single culpable participant who had the mens rea, who was supervised by the defendant, I think that wouldn't be enough. I don't think we argued it would have been enough in the brief, although our brief is a little bit vague on that point. My point is that it was clear, and Judge Hogan was correct, that at least one of the many people supervised by Martinez-Vega knew that the drugs were going to the United States. There were other issues that were going to be in this bucket of Mr. Martinez-Vega's, of his separate issues that weren't touched on. I'm happy to answer any questions if the court has any, but otherwise I've responded to the ones that they raised here today.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. You know, thank you for reminding me. I'm sorry. You were out of time, but I was actually going to give you 2 minutes. So.
2 minutes. I will try to be brief. A little bit about the history of the litigation concerning identifications. It's summarized at page, there's a motion I filed, second motion to dismiss. It's in the joint appendix at 1435. And I won't go through all the details, but let me just stress, this is not as benign as Mr. Levy believes it is, because the government had a standing obligation to inform the defense of any identifications. They failed to do that with respect to Ms. Ortiz. Oh, they told us about something she's seen in the United States when she looked at the car video. And that was such, you actually have that transcript, you asked for it specially. So you have to assume, I think, in all fairness, that it was not a matter of surprise to Mr. Garrido once Ms. Ortiz said, oh, no, I did identify him, that the government would, in fact, ask Mr. Garrido whether or not he showed pictures to her. And the government's response was, we have no records of that. And so it simply, unless... people are completely incompetent, and I do not accuse Mr. Levy's colleagues of being incompetent, that Mr. Garrido would have known that was an issue, would have been specifically asked about that by the government. And so to just say, oh, well, you know, he's just confused and just surprised, I think is completely unfair and does not reflect the continued pressure on by the defense, that is by me, to have these identifications disclosed.
The right that you'd be... the only remedy you asked for was a mistrial?
I think if you read that, you'll see that what happens is I filed that about a week later because the government was refusing to correct it. I don't know. I would have to look
to... Did you ask from the district court a stipulation or...
At some point I did, and that stipulation was turned down.
By the government?
What?
By the court or by the government?
Well, the government wasn't going to do it, and Judge Hogan didn't make them do it. And I believe that's discussed... In the pleadings that we have, but it's just simply to say, oh well, he just didn't know this was coming and was surprised. That's simply not true, or shouldn't be true, based on the government's own obligations to conduct this investigation.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Gary Seidel with Mr. Retta. I also represented Mr. Cuevas at trial. I believe that we have a total of 10 minutes for our individual issues, and I would like to reserve 2 for rebuttal and split equally the issues that I will deal with and that which Mr. Retta will deal with. As Judge Ginsburg noticed earlier, we made identification an issue in this case, and did indeed the issue in this case. More precisely, Mr. Cuevas was known as Mr. Cuevas, Erminso Cuevas Cabrera. He was never known as or used the alias of Mincho. In support of this, 2.5 years before the trial, for the first time in writing, we ask for any and all defendant's statements. None were received then. None were received throughout the course of the case, including the trial. I believe that Judge Millett's characterization of Francisco Garrido was indeed accurate. He was a witness who would say whatever he perceived the government wanted him to say, and he did. Indeed, I would analogize him to the Energizer Bunny prosecution witness. He kept on firing, irrespective of the questions that were asked, particularly of the prosecution, but also by us in cross-examination. He had, what I would submit, is an agenda. He was going to get out certain information, and indeed, the very first substantive question asked of him once he began to testify, after he completed his 30-year law enforcement experience, first as a New York City police officer, followed by his then-current DEA employment, was, how many suspects have you interviewed? Hundreds, his answer was, followed by, how many suspects have you provided Miranda warnings to? Again, hundreds. And the very next question, which begins the troop down this problematic road, was, where were you on September 17th of 2007? His answer was, I was performing an extradition of Erminso Cuevas Cabrera, known as Mincho. We opposed Garrido's testimony in the first instance when it was proffered that he's only going to testify about the extradition of our client from Colombia to the United States. What we submitted then and what we submit now was totally irrelevant to the sole indicted charge, conspiracy to import to the United States cocaine in an excess of 5 kilograms. Whether he got here on a 727 or a DC-9, it didn't matter. But not only was Garrido's testimony proffered as how he got here, but he would not say anything about any conversations. Juxtapose that proffer, Your Honor, with the first substantive question. How many people have you interviewed? Well, that's leading to a statement, the statement which ultimately says, where were you September 19th, 2007? I was performing an extradition, and when I asked him what his name was, are you Mincho, for the first time we have, yes, what I would characterize as a confession, the first and only confession of the use of the alias Mincho with Erminso Cuevas Cabrera. Never before had we gotten anything in discovery, and we didn't get any of that in any Jenks material for Garrido himself of 5 pages.
Didn't the judge strike that?
That's the problem, Your Honor. We first have the prejudice with the volunteered statement, yes, in response to the question, are you Mincho? Subsequently, because this came out of the blue, and as Mr. Redoretta said earlier in a slightly different context, we didn't want to start raising red flags about that. We had the tag team approach between prosecution and witness, Erminso Cuevas Cabrera, also known as Mincho, a total of 9 times throughout, over 3 pages. We had a bench conference. We opposed the disclosure for the first time of, yes, a statement attributable by Garrido to the defendant, and the trial judge did provide an instruction, what we were informed would be a curative instruction. Well, contrary to this court's strictures of both Foster and McClendon, it was an instruction that, one, repeated the problem information, including 3 times a reference to the alias Mincho, two, it added, yes, I am Mincho, which was not Garrido's testimony. And three,
it was the substance of it. Are you Mincho? Yes.
The Garrido response simply was, are you Mincho? Yes, period, for Garrido. The instruction by the trial court referenced, are you Mincho? Yes, I am Mincho. Nobody said, I am Mincho. That was compounded by the further problem we submit that the jury was given an explanation for why they were hearing this instruction to disregard, yes, I am Mincho, because it was due to a technicality. Now, the district court didn't say it's a technicality, but I submit the definition of technicality that was given was this was not provided before trial, and therefore I'm obligated to advise you, ignore it. So unlike Foster, unlike McClendon, we have repetition of the problematic language, we have addition to the problematic language, and then we have something that does us as defense attorneys no good, I submit, because, well, I'm forced to tell you this because the defendant's lawyers raised an issue. That is the problem.
How many other people identified him as Mincho in the trial?
Two of the government reinsertado witnesses, one being the cook at the lab, and the second being her brother, also
at this. Did you do a courtroom identification?
I don't recall. I don't recall now. But of the four Colombian witnesses, only those two referenced Mincho. Now, there was no direct conversation between either of those witnesses and Mr. Cuevas, where Mr. Cuevas said, call me Mincho. The sister simply overheard, or what she believes to have been an overheard conversation more than 6 years before her testimony, where the nickname or the alias came up. We presented three Colombian witnesses, however, who said, we know him, or Mincho Cuevas Cabrera, we've never known him to use or be known by the nickname of Mincho. These are people who had long-term dealings with Mr. Cuevas, the person who sold him his farm.
Yeah, but all this was presented to the jury, right? They had to believe one or the other.
They did, but the problem I submit with Garrido's testimony, are you Mincho? Yes, is that that tips the scales in favor of the two Colombian witnesses who had no direct conversation with Mr. Cuevas, but who claim we knew him or we heard him identified by the alias.
He disregarded what the judge told him to do.
Well, Judge Millett, I would submit that Garrido's volunteered information about, yes, are you Mincho, is tantamount to what we just experienced of a fire alarm going off in mid-proceeding. You are not going to forget it, regardless of what cautionary instruction may be given. And the cautionary instruction in this case is far over the line, I submit, from Foster and from McClendon. It repeated the information, it added to the information, and then it provided what I would characterize as a basis for that instruction that did us no good. And Garrido's testimony was like a rapid-fire gun. He volunteered stuff, specifically this conversation, which we were expressly informed was not coming. Was not coming. And this is after 2 or 3 hours of witness preparation before he testified. And it's out there. And he is the only one who has come up with, the defendant said this is his alias. It is more problematic because he was the only 30-year law enforcement witness who provided any alias information. He was the only witness who did not have an immunity agreement in two separate countries for whatever he was about to say. He was the only witness who did not receive substantial financial benefits for that testimony. He was the only witness who was not electronically tethered to the prosecution in this case, an issue that Mr. Retta will address. And he was the only one who claims to have had face-to-face conversations about the alias with Mr. Cuevas. I submit that all of those factors enhance what he intended to do, and that is make the sole connection of Mincho as an alias with this particular defendant, something that no one else in the entire trial did. And indeed, at the very beginning of this case, we received thousands of wiretaps with a Mincho on the Colombian end of those taps, which ultimately we were informed, wrong Mincho, wrong person. So the government needed in this case to have some kind of connection with Erminso Cuevas Cabrera must be Mincho for their case to work. And the government witnesses who they produced were all never involved with testifying before, looking down at their feet, not looking at the jury, were timid, didn't remember a lot of questions. And indeed, none of these government witnesses from Colombia ever volunteered this information about Mincho being Mr. Cuevas Cabrera to any law enforcement officer, either in Colombia or in the United States. It was only after they were contacted, years after the fact, by law enforcement and were specifically asked about it, did this information first come up, years after the fact. So I submit that not only was there a less than prompt cautionary instruction, and this was after 3 pages of testimony, after 3 pages of a bench conference, we have the cautionary instruction, which we didn't find out in terms of particulars about until we heard it, and that exacerbated the problem. This was on Thursday, March 4, 2010. On Monday morning, early, March 8, 2010, a written motion for mistrial was filed, in large part because of the problematic cautionary instruction, ultimately, that we heard. And the testimony was at the end of the trial day on the prior Thursday. Obviously, the court's aware that that motion for mistrial was denied, which is what gets us here on this particular issue. I would submit that it was prejudicial and that there was no instruction that's going to unring that bell in the minds and ears of the jurors in terms of the alias is being equated with the person seated in the courtroom.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Excuse me. Manuel Retoret on behalf of Mr. Cuevas. I have three issues that I'd like to speak to, and with the court's permission, I'd just like to, unless the court wishes, I'd like to start off with the tether that Mr. Seidel just referenced, which was the confrontation issue dealing with the ankle bracelet. Perspective of a trial attorney in court watching this happen, it was extraordinary. I was the one that actually saw the first sign of the bracelet. It manifested itself in a pant leg being a little bit fuller than the norm. And the court is now aware, given our submissions and the appendix, what happened after that. The core of this is I couldn't ask him about bias. Or I couldn't ask any of the others who were wearing that ankle bracelet about bias. I couldn't confront them on very basic issues such as, are you receiving a benefit from the government? Have you been housed by the government? Have they paid for your meals? Things like that. No, by the way, are you electronically attached to the government that has brought you to this country that has a close bilateral relation with the government that you are now serving and being monitored by in Colombia? It was a denial of witnesses that proved crucial to the government, a denial to ask them what they were thinking, and at least offer the jury the opportunity to think about whether this person that is now officially under the instructions classified as a cooperator, whether now this person has an extra level of thought that should be provided when they analyze that testimony. We made requests. The requests were for discovery. We wanted discovery as to what this was all about, who attached those bracelets, what they actually thought. We actually asked the district court judge to allow us to question, outside the presence of the jury, what the witnesses' impressions of what that bracelet meant. I mean, the explanations from the government ranged from it is something that is applied just in case they get lost, to the sinister of this is a very bad situation that they're in, and people could actually kill them.
But the defense does not have that. We cannot ask, we were not able to ask, and we did not have the ability to elicit in front of the jury what this person's bias could be. And these were critical witnesses. These were, as we've discussed everything today, we know these were the lab witnesses. These were the people that placed my client into the world of knowledge, intent, and identification. So we say that that was a violation. I turn to the admission of the lab video, which was another extraordinary event in the trial. And the court has the video. I would highlight, we've set it all out in the appendix, but I would highlight moment 12, minute 12, colon 07, 12 minutes, 7 seconds into the video. What happened with this video was that the ladies and gentlemen of the jury, they were essentially placed in the middle of the Civil War. But as we began to see what was happening, we protested, we objected, and we said, wait a minute, this video has nothing to do with this case.
What do you mean they were placed in the middle of the Civil War?
At that point in the video, 1207, it goes from the witness testimony, who was a Columbia National Police officer, of the lab, and here are the barrels, and this is how it's processed. And the last thing you see before that moment is one of the Army regulars showing the testing of the cocaine. It's turning blue. Here it is. And then suddenly you get into vamonos, vamonos. And the vamonos is, let's get out of here, because they are coming. Now, what you see after that is they are getting out of there. They are blowing up the lab. And
you
as
see the other people coming, you don't see the Civil War. You hear people say vamonos, but maybe it's because they were ready to start the fires and burn the stuff up.
Indeed. But the witness states clearly what was happening. We were receiving fire from across the river. We had to get out of there because we thought they could be coming.
Well, that's a problem from the witness, not from the video.
Well, for the purposes of the video, it's akin to showing a search warrant video of a house in Northwest, and then saying, welcome to the trial in for this house in Northeast, and showing that video.
That's a different point from putting the jury in the middle of the Civil War. That's just a question about whether it's relevant to have a videotape from one crime to show, to be used to try to show in another crime.
Right.
That's a different point.
But to address your question, when the witness who was a fact/expert witness tells the jury, this is what's happening, they're firing at us, the helicopters are there because they're shooting and giving us cover, he's making reference to the FARC. And his description...
Did they not have other testimony from... have other testimony that they knew there was... the FARC was not just cocaine distributors, but also an armed revolutionary group?
Yeah.
Is it war with the Colombian government?
But they were placed right in the middle of it with that video. That video is extraordinary. That video creates fear. That video is apprehension. You hear the vamonos, vamonos. The fear in those Colombian Army members is present. And my concern is that that jury is taken an irrelevant piece of evidence being shown and then receiving testimony from the fact/expert witness that, hey, it's them. They're coming at us. And oh, by the way, they're members over there. I mean, the prejudice spillover from, especially from something that was absolutely irrelevant to the case at trial, was extraordinary. It could have, again, the could have portion of this. The government could have presented a photograph, or they could have created windows of each video frames. These are the barrels. Lieutenant Colonel, is that how it's done? Yes, it is. This is the area where the leaves are dried. Is that how it's done? Yes, it is. But the video was a movie that brought them into the war. You can describe it. The FARC is a guerrilla movement, and the Colombian government is fighting with the FARC. But to bring them into a war scene, the prejudice was extraordinary.
With the court's permission, if I may just reference the electronic surveillance, our interesting our point with that is that satellite phones being used and requested of district court judges to be used strictly outside of the United States. Some distinction with some of the other cases where listening posts are here or cell phones are pinging off of towers here in the United States. The interesting thing here was that these cell phones were strictly to be used to be placed in and infiltrate the FARC, location, conversations. And that is what the judge in the Southern District of Florida actually made a ruling on, saying that this is going to go outside of the country. Not so much focusing on listening posts or data collection centers. But we challenge.
How does it help you if Title III doesn't apply outside the United States, and you say there wasn't sufficient nexus to the U.S., then you're out of luck. It seems like you want Title III just to apply enough to give you relief, but not enough to allow a judge here to authorize a wiretap. If Title III doesn't reach over there, then doesn't reach over there, you get no protection from it.
Your Honor's right. Sometimes we make arguments at the trial level saying, hey, look, we've received these wiretaps from another country, and we can't trust them. We don't have the same level of confidence that we have with Title III. You're absolutely right. But the interesting thing here is when a judge is presented with an affidavit that says we're not going to do anything in the United States with these telephones, these phones are going out there. They're going to go into the jungles of Colombia. They're never going to see a U.S. cell tower. And the only thing we can tell the court is they're going to ping off of a satellite, and they're somehow going to be linked into maybe a Rockville address or maybe a data collection center that I believe was Connecticut and California in this case. Is that appropriate for Title III? We would argue it's not.
Did you make that argument?
We didn't make the jurisdiction argument, and that's why we're working under plain error.
Okay.
With that, I thank the court.
All right. Thank you.
I'll start quickly with the wiretap. They didn't make the argument below. I don't believe they're even working under plain error. I think it's waived. You can't take a suppression issue, put it in your pocket, gamble on an acquittal, and then pull it out again after you fail.
The version of Rule 12 that governs at this stage doesn't have that waiver language, and so
it's less clear, I think, what the...
Aren't we in plain error land? Like, it may not make a difference, but aren't we in plain error land?
It's possible. The rule has historically been waiver. I'm not sure that the change in Rule 12... A, I'm not sure it's retroactive to, I'm not sure.
Pretty settled law that you apply the version of the rules of criminal procedure because they're procedural that's in effect at the time of decision. Supreme Court said that.
Okay. I'm.
Again, we don't.
I don't think we need to decide it for sure.
Let's assume plain error.
All right. So assuming plain error, there is no error, but... there's certainly nothing plain about it, even if there were error. Every circuit court that has thought about the issue of a listening post as being jurisdictional has said that you do have jurisdiction where the listening post is. So the idea that it's clear that you don't and that would be plain error is incorrect. There's also the potential overlay of good faith. All of this was laid out in an affidavit for the judge who issued the wiretap.
We don't know if the good faith exception applies to Title III.
We do not know, but it's certainly not plain that it doesn't. And as a result, that's another issue where were this done to succeed on...
Did the court apply good faith exception here?
I'm sorry?
I guess the district court didn't apply the good faith
exception. The district court didn't... Well, the district court...
Right. So
it was never raised, so they didn't have to one way or another.
Right, exactly. So I'm not sure how good faith factors normally requires... Anyhow.
My argument would be that had this been raised below, the issue of good faith, this court would have to
litigate the issue of whether good faith should apply.
Exactly. And so if there were error here, mm-hmm. and if it were plain, if this is not an appropriate jurisdictional use of Title III, even so, you then have to turn to the issue of whether or not there's good faith. It is not clear whether good faith applies to a Title III or not, but that's another issue that is not plain on appeal. It may well apply, and to carry their burden, the defense has to show, A, that this was plainly erroneous, and B, that it is clear that good faith is not a concept that you can apply in Title III. My point being, there are a lot of unresolved issues that would have to be resolved in order to do this. That's not what plain error is. Plain error is where it's crystal clear that they're entitled to relief. That is not this case by any stretch. And then on top of that, there is the issue that you raised, Judge Millett, that that all we get from the fact that Title III doesn't cover this wiretap, if it were true, which it's not, is that maybe there's no protection for the defendants. And again, not an issue on which that can be decided on plain error. On the issue of the bracelets, there's not much to be said about that. That cross-examination was, it's hard to even understand exactly what the relevance of the cross-examination was, but on top of that, Judge Hogan spoke with the marshals, determined that the bracelets were on for a security concern of the, for the security of the witnesses, and correctly concluded that if he were going to allow cross-examination on why they are wearing the bracelets, the government would have to be able to explain that there is this security concern to rebut the arguments, whatever they were, that the defense would be making, and that would lead to just a whole number of issues that appropriately should not have been brought in at trial. On the testimony about Minsho, there are a few things on that. My adversary said that no instruction would unring that bell. That certainly cannot be true. It cannot be the case that this whole trial had to come to a halt and a mistrial had to be granted because there was some passing reference to a defense admission that he was Minsho. Certainly some instruction would unring the bell. The instruction that the judge gave was the instruction that he was effectively the instruction that he told the defense he was going to give. This was not a bombshell, by the way. It took 8 questions for the defense to even figure out that this was something that they cared about. It wasn't the moment that it hit and everybody recognized it. It was 8 questions later when they said, hey, can we have a sidebar? By the way, we didn't know about this in the past, but apparently there was testimony that the defendant identified himself as Minsho. The reason it was not a bombshell is because the defendant's identification as Minsho was largely irrelevant. This is not like Chiquigo, and even there, Judge Hogan in post-trial orders and opinions said the issue of identifying him as Chiquigo was not all that relevant. That holds completely true for Minsho. One of the witnesses testified that everybody named Erminso is called Minsho. It's just a diminutive. There was nothing about some unidentified Minsho out there committing acts, and this is that Minsho. The witnesses knew him as Minsho, but more importantly, the witnesses knew what he did. His identity was never in dispute. He was the brother of the head FARC commander in the area, and a number of witnesses said he was a leader and the operator of a cocaine lab. Whether or not he was Minsho was nothing to anyone, and I would submit that's why the question got asked, answered, and it took 8 questions later for anybody to figure it out. At that point, the judge said, okay, I'm going to strike it. I'm going to give the instruction to disregard. I have the exact language here, but he says, I'm going to tell the jury to ignore the defendant's statement that he was Minsho. And the defense said, thank you. At that point, if they thought there was some other instruction that was going to cure this more precisely than what the judge was about to say, it was their obligation to say so. They were happy with what they got at the time. And it did cure it completely, and there was no other way to do it. 8 questions later, there's no other way to tell the jury what testimony it is that they're supposed to strike. And then finally, one last thing on that: we have in our brief at page 69, there are 4 people who ID'd the defendant as Minsho. Finally, on the Jungle Lab video, I want to state right up front that the defense is right and we are wrong in our brief. That this was a Jungle Lab in the 16th Front. They point that out. The confusion there was there were some still images that had come in that were from the 16th Front. This was a Jungle Lab that was in the 1st Front, I believe. But to be clear on that, that was a mistake in our briefing on appeal. That was never a source of confusion at trial. Judge Hogan, it was perfectly clear at trial that this was a Jungle Lab from the from the First and I believe Seventh Fronts. So we have injected that error on appeal or that confusion, but I'm trying to withdraw it. That said, the reason it came in was precisely because this was a jungle lab operated by the conspiracy, and we were fortunate to have a piece of evidence that allowed the jury to see that. Otherwise, they got relatively dry descriptions of what a jungle lab looks like. If you have not seen the video, it's illuminating, as it was for the jury, to be able to see what a jungle lab looks like the one that Mr. Cuevas was running. There is no civil war in this video if you take a look at it. It is a raid, to be sure. They're going into enemy territory, and they are quickly blowing up a lab and getting out, and that's what you see. At the very end, there's a description by the witness. You would miss it as being the helicopter rotors if it weren't described by the witness, where he says, oh, that's fire that we're taking as we're taking off. But it is fire that, I mean, it was explained to the jury, so it is what it is. But this was a case where we put on evidence that this conspiracy was an armed insurgency that trafficked in cocaine. A video that shows that, even if it did, which it largely did not, but even if it did, that is evidence of the conspiracy and relevant. There's been no particular explanation why the unfair prejudice, what the unfair prejudice is, or why it would substantially outweigh the obvious relevance of this video, and on top of that, why it would be a grave abuse of discretion for Judge Hogan to have concluded otherwise. I think that covers all of the points, so the government will rest on its briefs at this point. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Everybody was out of town, but we will give you each 1 minute if you need to follow up on something.
Thank you.
With respect to the Garrido prejudicial confession, as I will refer to it, the problematic testimony came on March 4. Trial began actually on February 24 with several days devoted to picking a witness. In short, we were in the first week of this 7-week trial, and therefore it is not as though we'd completed 90% and it would be a bigger loss to declare a mistrial early on in the trial. The government, from its opening statement, referred to Mr. Cuevas' brother, who was one of the top individuals indicted in this 51 co-defendant case, and in short, established guilt by association. This is the guy who's down at the bottom, number 49 on the indictment list, who's the brother of number one. And number one, we know, is a big person in FARC, and therefore this guy's guilty because of that association. The defense was not happy with the district court's proposed instruction because it didn't say, I'm going to repeat the problematic information, I'm going to add to it, and I'm also going to provide an explanation why. There was no discussion, for instance, I'm going to tell a jury this is a Rule 16 violation, which the prosecution concedes. What we got was not what was previewed at the bench. What we got was more problematic, clearly over the line, I suggest, in terms of both the description of the instruction in Foster and in McClendon. The district court did not interrupt any improper answers. In fact, it went back and forth several times. Indeed, after the bench conference, after the jury instruction, the very next question by the prosecutor was, Erminso Cuevas Cabrera, also known as Mincho, were hammering home that alias, and therefore I submit that the evidence establishes that this was important to us, and it was certainly important to the prosecution at that time. Beyond that, I believe I have nothing further, and the red light is indeed on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And unless Your Honors have a question about that video, or the ankle bracelet, or the title.
Well, what is the prejudice of the video?
Your Honor, I was able to go back into the appendix and reread the Lieutenant Colonel's testimony. We are receiving fire. We're receiving fire from the FARC. These are members of the FARC that are sitting right across from you, ladies and gentlemen of the jury. The machine guns were coming from the helicopters. We had to get out of there. It's a very volatile situation.
It's because of this individual and his organization that are there. It is...
You're saying they actually blamed the defendants for the gunfire shown in the video?
Yes, it's the inference. It's the inference. We're there. We're breaking up a FARC lab. We're under fire from the FARC. And I'm here describing what the FARC does, and the government takes the easy step and, you know, will argue later and does argue later, this is the FARC. This is the struggle that's going on.
Isn't it in the record, maybe you brought it out, that the witnesses were guilty, you've acknowledged guilty of the guilt of various crimes, including murder?
In Colombia?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Hard to see how you can build on, how you could further prejudice.
Well, it would be, if the error that the government acknowledged regarding the identification of the front were the case, and I appreciate that they noted that, if this was a front that was associated with my client, the relevance is there. But the relevance here was just not there. We're raiding a house on one street, and we're going to introduce that video in the trial of a house on another street. We've had large conspiracy cases here, and we do not have, in the Murder Inks, in the Moores, in the Gray cases, we do not have videos being introduced, although it is a large conspiracy, and there are defendants and addresses all over the town. We do not have the raid of one house being shown as an example of what they did in another house. It's just not done. And yet we have that here. So we have that baseline. But then beyond that, if it were just to be the example, if it were just to show the workings of the lab, that would be in a good spot, I would argue. You're doing a good job. You're showing them, here's where the sink is. Here is maybe where the methamphetamine was cooked. But in this case, it goes far beyond that. This is what it goes to that to a certain point.
I understand the argument about relevance. I want to know about the prejudice, though.
The prejudice is that the violence that is associated with this video, the mayhem, the explosion, all of that is attributed directly to my client, and that's not even admitting that the client is responsible for what the government claims. My client's not there as a fighter. If we accept the government's argument, my client is there as a lab worker. While the FARC and the Colombian government may have this large-scale war going on, my client is supposedly there making sure that the barrels are there, the gasoline is there, and the people are fed and people are working. Yet suddenly, now he's a guerrilla that's killing people and killing and shooting at the witness that the government has presented. And if the government feels good about that person that they brought up here, then we should feel good about that, and we should have some problems with that defendant and his organization. If they would have just had the video frames, I argue we would have been okay. The fact that they played the whole thing, the fact that we were not... The fact that the ladies and gentlemen of the jury were able to sit and experience this war movie—I mean, it's a war movie—prejudiced my client.
I'm going to see the video, so you're not setting me up here for disappointment.
I'm not going to spoil it for you.
That'll be a spoiler. Really,
I'm not going to spoil it, but I'll tell you to look at 12:07, 12 minutes and 7 seconds in.
All right.
Right there. I thank the court for the time.
Thank you, Mr. Gilbert, Mr. Seidel, and Mr. I know that you were appointed to assist this court, and we appreciate your assistance.
Your Honor.